Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, March 22nd, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political panel. This month, our theme was Off the Hill, We Want Gender Equality and Affirmative Action, Not Lip Service. In the panel, we discuss the many issues facing women and gender diverse people in Canada and around the world. Our panel featured social entrepreneur PK Much and Professor Nadia Abuzara, co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Here is a small clip from that panel. Take a listen.
Well, we begin with a general opener for both of our panelists. Faced with critical issues such as missing and murdered Indigenous women, genocide against whole populations disproportionately affecting women and children, such as we are witnessing now in Palestine, loss of reproductive rights and false narratives about trans rights, what should we be demanding of the Canadian government and Parliament? Let's start with you, Nadia, and then we'll go to PK.
Well, I think what we should be demanding is all the rights you listed. I think those are so important. And I think we take them for granted as if everyone has them. We not everyone has them. And that's so amply clear when people are having cesarean sections without anesthetics, when people are giving birth to stillborn at an increased rate, chiefly because a war of genocide is being waged against them. So we don't have all of these rights. And I think the first ask is to ensure that people do have equal opportunities to have to be alive, to have an enjoyment in life, and to have the bare minimum, the basics, to be able to survive. And we can do so much more than we're doing at the moment. And this will come up again and again in our discussions today, but we can't start from a colonial position. We can't begin by saying colonialism is okay here, therefore it might be okay somewhere else. Therefore, how can we help with women and girls and, you know, two-spirit people and trans people and so on? I don't think that's where we can start. We have to start by saying colonialism has never been okay. And if, 2024 is a bit late in saying that, but better late than never.
Yeah, I love what you said, Nadia. Echo here, except I would add to colonialism has never been okay, that capitalism has never been okay either. And it depends on exploitation of certain folks, certain groups, any group it can get its hands on. And I think that's part of why we aren't getting the movement we need in these spaces. I mean, we all remember, as 2015 when Justin Trudeau stood up and said, I'm a feminist. And, I have to say that, since then, the Liberal government has made a significant amount of investments in the women's foreign policy area, in women's entrepreneurship, and a number of other initiatives. So, have they worked? Not entirely, because you can't, it's a little bit like chipping away at one side of the block without looking at the rest of it. You can't overhaul or change society by just kind of tweaking a part here and there. You have to look at the larger systems. And we haven't seen a lot of change in how capitalism works in Canada. So without some shifts on that front, I don't see how we're ever going to see shifts on anti-Black racism, on the struggle for economic equity, and all of the things that you already mentioned, Nadia. So that's what I kind of see is one of the things standing in the way.
Yeah, and Robin, I'm going to jump in here as well, knowing that Charlotte could not join us tonight. So I'm going to add some commentary as well to the questions that you raised. So I hope people will be okay with that. But, the question that you put to us is, what should we be demanding of the Canadian government and parliament? And I think, you know, this is a very important question, because for me, it's about accountability. When you look at the question that you asked and the issues that you raised, reproductive rights, genocide, missing and murdered women, I mean, these are all issues, and many other issues, where there actually positions have been taken. And in fact, there are laws in place that protect the rights that we have, right? Sometimes there are policies that have evolved over the decades, but in many cases, especially for reproductive rights, or you think about international law on genocide that Canada is a signatory to, you think of the Royal Commission on the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit people. When you think of trans rights, I mean, these are all rights that, quote, we have won. They're rarely given. They're usually won through a monumental struggle that can take anywhere from decades to hundreds of years. But what I've learned, you know, I was a member of parliament for 18 years, so it was sort of like, you know, in the belly of the beast, so to speak. And what I learned is that when things are written in policy or even in legislation, it's not enough. That the accountability part, the follow-up part, the holding to account part is equally, if not more important than, you know, the law itself. And you know, I've encountered many people over the years who would say, wow, you know, that was great. We won that. And yeah, you know, these were hard fought victories for women, for gender diverse people. And they're still ongoing struggles. But I've always felt that there's absolutely no way that we can kind of rest on our laurels, right? These are ongoing struggles. And each of these issues require vigilance to protect the rights that have been won. I mean, if you look at the question of Canada's foreign policy on Palestine, if you look at the actual policy of the Canadian government, it's actually not that bad. It's just that they don't ever adhere to it. It was even the same under Stephen Harper. He didn't actually change the foreign policy on what's now called Global Affairs website. It remained the same, amazingly. But of course, you know, they completely turned a blind eye to it. So I do think this question in terms of what should we be demanding of the government and parliament, it is very much about, you know, unfortunately, remaining vigilant. And there's a difference between the government and parliament. I mean, the government is the government, they have the majority, but parliament as a whole is also an institution that is accountable, and it does have various mechanisms for accountability, for example, on the environment, on ethics. I mean, there are commissioners who are meant to help provide that accountability. But on the issues that you've raised, Robin, there is no internal kind of parliamentary mechanism that I can think of that automatically produces a process for accountability and sort of that vigilance. So this means that, you know, whether it's the women's movement, the trans movement, the anti-racism movement, you know, these are all things that we actually have to take up and not just sort of say, well, now it's the government's responsibility. It surely is, but it won't happen unless we actually keep forcing it to happen. So I just kind of wanted to add that perspective. And just one other point. I mean, PK, you noted, you know, sort of the colonial position. Oh, no, you both did. Nadia, you did too. And I mean, the weird irony is that, yes, we live in a, you know, a democracy, a liberal democracy, but the most colonial institution is parliament itself. You know, the traditions, the practices, it's all vested in a horrible, you know, British imperialist, colonialist, history, right? So even unpacking that and undoing that to bring about change. So believe me, it's not only a struggle externally, it's a struggle internally. And you can talk to pretty well any progressive woman member of parliament, and they'll tell you about what that struggle is like to kind of reform the institution from the inside as well.
Mm.
Yes.
Well,
go ahead,
is there
PK.
An order to this, or can I just jump in?
Jump right in.
Maybe you have me like fired up. I'm sure Nadia is fired up now too. So, okay. It took me a minute to warm up. So I want to kind of build on what you just said. And, you know, what can government do was kind of the question, what should change, et cetera. And the policies are there and the laws are there, but change doesn't necessarily happen. And a good example is the trans rights discussion or trans rights issue, because the law is pretty clear. The Canadian Human Rights Act says that gender identity and expression, you know, hate is prohibited and grounds for discrimination and all of those things. The law is there, but we still have people showing up at libraries being anti-trans, and we have people, you know, in other provinces being anti-trans. So I want to bring it to this. I'm wondering if we have an over-reliance on government to make the change. I mean, after all, aren't governments supposed to be, and I know this is not always the case, but, you know, representative of the people. But I feel like we have left it to the laws and the government without actually doing the kind of action we need to have on the streets and in communities. So here's a quick example. Someone flies a offensive flag in a neighborhood and the rest of the neighborhood looks away. Nobody does anything about it because they don't want to upset the neighbor and so on. And I feel like we've forgotten how to be true citizens and fight for what we believe in. Instead, we leave that to someone else. So I think that calling on government to change is one angle, but I also think we have to change.
Yep. I can. Nadia, did you want to add anything to the discussion on that?
I do. My answer will always be yes. I want to go back to this notion of accountability, both what you were saying, Libby, and also PK, how you were saying this needs to move, you know, to be widespread. I think there is an enormous role for accountability to be part of our education system. Mm-hmm. I think that instead of, you know, this is what you get on an exam or the quiz at the end of your grade six, you know, term or whatever, because we have this culture of examinations going down to childhood and up into adulthood. And then, of course, you get in the work world. No one gives you an exam. I mean, if they do, I'd be very surprised. I'd be very curious as to what work environment issues examinations to their employees. And so, or their clients that... And so instead of, you know, this culture of examination and this culture of transmission, you know, you must have knowledge transmitted to you or from you. What if we relied instead on notions of accountability through the education system and we built up a culture of accountability? And, you know, please don't take this as my original idea. There are entire books written on this by Anishinaabe writers, Nehiyaw writers, you know, entire histories are built on the notion of relational accountability, and entire futures are being constructed that are beautiful and remarkable, that are being generally, I think, ignored, relatively speaking. And if we would bring that into not only our education systems, but the way we try to be in everything that we do, then maybe we would be more collective in our demands for accountability and would not allow things to pass that essentially are mass murder, individual murder. We're talking about femicide. We're talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. These are really important issues that if accountability were there, as you both said, maybe, you know, we can move on these issues and prevent these kinds of things from happening and hold accountable those who perpetrate these kinds of things. That's on accountability. But I like, again, what you said, Pico, about collectivity. We need to move as collectives. We're not practiced in that. I don't think we're practiced in that. Again, our education systems, especially, I come from post-secondary, especially post-secondary, are individualizing. And, you know, we're taught to work together when we're four and five. By the time we're 24, we're competitors. And wouldn't it be great if we worked as collectives, if we practiced? And it's not easy. It's not easy. I mean, after you get past three people, it can get difficult. But it is important. And we can move mountains if we work collectively, especially in holding people and holding ourselves and one another accountable.
Yeah. And I just want to add to that on this question of accountability, because, you know, I think we look at accountability as some kind of informal, like it's just going to happen, it's spontaneous, but it isn't. You actually have to write it in. You have to build it into whatever change is taking place. So there are some examples now where, like, if a law is passed around equality rights or something like that, that part of the legislative process is including a process of accountability that empowers not just the government, but the people who, you know, who are part of that transformation to provide the accountability. And, you know, I this is one thing that always sticks out in my head. When I first got elected, it was just at the conclusion of the Royal Commission on, at the time it was called Aboriginal Peoples. It was a massive Royal Commission. And I always remember this one recommend, I read the report and there was this one recommendation that it was very concrete. It said to hire 10, train and hire 10,000 healthcare providers in Indigenous communities who were Indigenous. It just happened to stick in my head. And of course, nothing ever happened. I mean, maybe there's, you know, a couple of thousand more, but because there was no process of follow-up or accountability, and it was the same with the missing and murdered women in BC, we had a separate inquiry. And I argued strenuously that accountability had to be part of the report. And for the federal report, they did include that. But even so, it didn't, there weren't mechanisms that could empower the community, because, you know, you can't just do it, you know, off the side of your desk and say, well, I'm a great volunteer. And, well, you know, I'll just add that on my list now. Right. I mean, this has to be resourced. It has to be mandated. And so I do think it's part of our sort of democratic process that is, Nadia, you've made this point, it's totally underlooked. It's totally overlooked that we kind of miss the boat when it comes to, well, how do we get people the resources and the way to actually hold that accountability, right? You know, make it very visible. So I think it's a very good identification in the discussion that we're having this evening.
But PK, in a Rabble article you wrote on Toronto's March 7th International Women's Day's march that drew thousands of people, you said the central to this year's rally was the ongoing Palestinian genocide, in particular, how the media has underreported that over 70% of the people massacred in Palestine so far were women and children. As a former magazine publisher, do you think that the mainstream media is advancing or hindering progress on gender issues? We'll start with you, and then Nadia, you can certainly jump in. Oh, Libby, too.
One of the great things about International Women's Day and the coalition of organizers that puts that on for the last 50 or so years is that they every year pick a theme. And last year it was the Iranian women's struggle. So the theme was women, liberation, and freedom. And then this year it was focused on the Palestinian women and how they were experiencing the war in Gaza. And there were several speakers and that really talked about this, and it was really well done. But I'm going to switch over to the media side of this. And as a magazine publisher, I did a little bit of work on this, and this is not a scientific study, okay? But what I started to notice was that not only does media not cover, especially mainstream media, not cover what's happening with women in Palestine and in Israel, is they're taking a very particular sort of ideal victim approach. So let me tell you what I mean. When you look at, if you do this Google search yourself on images and news stories on Palestine, the war in Gaza, and particularly women, if you look at North American media, you get a lot of pictures like this. And I don't know if you can see this or not, but you get women mourning, women holding babies, women mourning. Again, a lot of mourning happening. And these are the, you know, whether it's New York Times or The Guardian or HuffPost, these are the images where these are the stories that are being told about the poor women of Gaza and, you know, the maternity deaths and malnutrition of pregnant mothers and all pregnant mothers and all of that stuff. But what's not being told is the strength of Palestinian women and their ability to organize and kind of lead. There's stuff happening. And I wanted to hearken back to a study that actually was done in, believe it or not, 2011 by the American University in Cairo, Egypt, on Palestinian women, the Western press, and the first Infatada. And one of those things this study noted, and this is not that long ago, noted that there was a striking, and I'm going to quote here, a striking portrayal of positively unseen in previous Palestinian struggles for autonomy, women marching defiantly through the plumes of choking smoke, Palestinian women in many cases portrayed as their male counterparts, as sort of having a role in liberation or a role in the war, etc., and so on. And there were lots of groups and organizations and so on, and we're not seeing that. Instead, and the pictures from that, from actually non-Western media, so I checked to see what was happening there, is you do find more images of Palestinian women organizing and taking agency and sort of, you know, working for change in addition to caring for their families and other kinds of things. So I wondered about that and what the impact of that might be. So just wanting to say that there's this kind of using women as the ideal victim, as a way of garnering sympathy. But we also want to tell the other story of women with strength and agency in these spaces. And that is almost completely missing. And when I looked at Canadian mainstream media, and you know, again, this was not scientific, but if you do the Google search yourself, what I found really striking was there were more white women that came up in stories about Palestine and women than actually than other women, than racialized women or Palestinian women. So I'm wondering what's going on in the news coverage. And I would say that as a magazine publisher and as a feminist publisher, I would be publishing these stories, not just the stories of the tragedies, as important as they are.
You took the words out of my mouth. The first moment you asked that question, I was thinking of this doctor who ran, through all sorts of, you know, missiles and bullets and fire and explosions in the night. And she's running, she's crouched and she's running. And then she's referred to in all this media as a nurse, and people correcting, you know, like, unfortunately, medicine can be hierarchical rather than recognizing that, you know, nurses actually do important roles. But there's this notion that women are nurses, men are doctors, and so on. So everyone referred to her as the Palestinian nurse. And people had to write in and say, no, sorry, you know, if she were a nurse, that would be wonderful, but she happens to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that what is missing is the resilience. And it's very difficult to be faced with this.
That was a small clip from Rabble's most recent Off the Hill political panel. To watch the entire panel, please visit Rabble TV or Rabble's YouTube channel. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, an opposition motion calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, put forward by the NDP, passed in the House of Commons. The motion had originally called for the immediate recognition of a Palestinian state, but that and other sections of the motion were watered down in order to gain support from the ruling Liberal government. The non-binding motion, which was passed, does call for Canada to support the International Court of Justice while it investigates Israel for alleged war crimes in Gaza and raises the restriction on Palestinians seeking visas to come to Canada to escape the war. Some activists argue that this motion is a small victory that could have gone further, but they also note that it shows that months of protests and pressure from activists has led elected officials to finally act. In labor news, A new report titled The Invisible Entrepreneur shows that women entrepreneurs continue to have a harder time in securing funding to grow their small businesses than their male counterparts. The report was authored by an alliance of women's groups, unions, and chambers of commerce, including the Canadian Women's Chamber of Commerce, the Canadian Labor Congress, the Canadian Women's Foundation, and others. Rabble founder and project advisor Judy Rebick remarked on the report by saying, quote, "The problem is not that women entrepreneurs are less ambitious. It's the impact of systemic discrimination that is still embedded in institutions, when it's the banks giving money or corporate clients who pay women-owned enterprises less for the same services. We have to fix this." End quote. Staying in labor news, the 2024 Alberta budget is being criticized for failing to focus on the retention of firefighters to fight wildfires. With the wildfire season already underway in February, the Conservative Alberta government has made no provisions in this year's budget for items to encourage their wildfire firefighters to stay in their grueling and dangerous jobs. The Alberta Union of Public Employees pointed out that this budget offers no benefits or pay increases to firefighters. They are concerned that this will lead to a drain of experienced firefighters. Last year's wildfires burned over 2 million hectares of land in Alberta. And finally, in environmental news, David Suzuki continues to warn of the dangers that the fossil fuel industry's propaganda poses to us all. Suzuki points to the industry's promotion of liquid natural gas as a transition fuel away from oil as particularly dangerous. He notes that according to the International Energy Agency, it will be impossible for the world to reach its climate goals if it continues to burn natural gas. Renewable energy is already cheap and viable, as proven by California, the most popular state in the nation in the U.S., which frequently produces more than enough renewable energy to meet its needs and then some. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
folks. Joey KSC.